Nine animals collided in a spinning whirl of mass of fur, teeth, and hoof above the dead calf. I crawled out from underneath the tree, lay on my belly, and watched. She was standing over the calf, kicking. I heard bones crunching and saw wolves flying some 20 feet into the air. One jumped from somewhere, latched itself to her hindquarters, and began tearing while another jumped onto her throat and clung to her windpipe and jugular. A third and fourth began tearing at her from underneath. Two more were still tearing at the calf. Two lay unmoving on the snow. With little regard for herself, she kicked the two atop the calf, sending them spinning through the air like footballs. Then she turned her attention to those that had latched onto her. She bucked and kicked and filled the air with splattering wolf blood and shattered wolf teeth. Within seconds, the wounded wolves had retreated to the trees, whining. They stood off some 60 or 80 yards, considering their options. She stood in the moonlight, breathing heavily, her own blood dripping on the snow, straddling the calf, nudging it with her muzzle. Every few minutes she'd fill her stomach with air and sound a deep bellow. I crawled into my bag, sat on top of my pack, and leaned against the tree. The wolves circled for another hour, made one feigned charge, then disappeared over the ridgeline, their howling echoing into the distance. In the hours that followed, she stood over the calf, shielding it from the snow that had returned. The field of red she had created slowly turned to white, burying the memory. At daylight, when the calf was little more than a white mound beneath her, the cow bellowed one last time and wandered off into the trees. Quietly, I pulled the calf into the trees. Its hams or hindquarters were gone, having been eaten, or at least torn off by the wolves. Its shoulders, too, had been chewed at, but some meat remained. I cut out the back straps, pulled as much meat as I could off the tops of the shoulders and the tenderloins from inside, between the shoulder blades. Doing so gave me maybe 30 pounds of meat, enough to feed us for a week to 10 days, or more. I tied it down into my pack and went to retrieve the bow where I'd dropped it during the charge. It lay in pieces. The limbs had shattered, cams had broken, the string lay in a bird's nest of a mess, and all the arrows had snapped when she'd stepped on it. I left it. I strapped on the snowshoes and walked back to the lake. At the far end I could see the A-frame, the fire glowing bright through the glass. I doubted Ashley had slept. I reached the red brick road and stopped. In the distance the cow bellowed. She would probably do that all day and into tomorrow. I wasn't sad for killing the calf. We needed to eat. If given the chance, I'd do it again. I wasn't sad that the cow was lonely. She'd have another calf. Most had twins or triplets when they gave birth. The thing that had my stomach in knots was the sight of the mother standing over her young. I sank my hand into the snow, ran my fingers through the clumps of red. Fresh snow had covered most of it. Only a dim outline remained. In an hour, there would be no reminder. Maybe it was my 23rd morning, my weakened condition, my own weariness, the weight of the recorder pressed against my chest, the fading bellows of the cow, the thought of Ashley hurt and worried. Maybe it was all of the above. I fell forward, landing on my knees, my pack driving me into the snow, which rose around my thighs. I scooped my hand beneath a red clump the size of my fist, lifted it to my nose, and breathed. To my left stood a tall pine, straight and spiraling upward maybe 60 feet. The first limbs didn't sprout out until some 30 feet up the trunk. I unbuckled my pack, pulled the hatchet from my belt, and crawled to the tree. With several good swings, I cut a band, maybe 2 feet long, 3 inches wide, and an inch or two deep, into and around the base. Come summer, when the heat rose, drawing the sap up, it would ooze and trickle out the scar like tears. Chances are it would do that for several years. Chapter 41. You were right. You were right all along. Chapter 42. Ashley's face told me all I needed to know. I shuffled in and put down my pack. I didn't realize how drained I was until I tried to speak. I shrugged. I tried to call, but the line was busy. She smiled, squinted her eyes, and fingered me closer. I knelt next to her. She raised her hand to my left eye, gently brushing it. You've been cut. Deep, too. Her palm brushed my cheek. You okay? Next to her, the puzzle lay complete. The picture had come together. It was a panoramic view of snow-capped mountains and a sun behind. You finished it. I turned my head, squinted my eyes. Is it a sunrise or sunset? She lay back, closed her eyes. I think that depends on the eye of the viewer. I spent the day cutting strips of meat and slow-cooking them over the fire. Ashley held up a small mirror and flinched while I sewed up the skin above my eye. 7 stitches in all. We ate off and on all day. If we even thought about food, we tore off a piece and chewed. Napoleon, too. We gave ourselves permission. We didn't gorge, but we weren't hungry either. By nighttime, we were content. All 3 of us. She asked me to run a bath, which I did. While she bathed, I packed the sled. We didn't have much left. My pack, our bags, the blankets, the hatchet, the meat. Anything that wasn't necessary, I left, lightening the load. I helped Ashley out of the bath, got her tucked into bed, then bathed myself, not knowing if and when I'd have another chance. I was asleep by nightfall, and slept until just before daylight, maybe 12 hours in all. The longest stretch since the crash. In truth, the longest stretch in years. A decade, maybe. Surgeons, especially trauma surgeons, are pretty good at making tough decisions, making them quickly and under a good bit of stress. I'd been struggling with hours. What to do? Go? Stay. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay by that warm fire and hope somebody stumbled upon us. But we'd gotten lucky with the calf. I could hunt my whole life and not get that chance again. Not to mention the fact that the bow had been destroyed. I thought about setting the A-frame on fire, just torching the whole place. But there was no guarantee that someone would investigate. And if we got 3 days out and had not gotten anywhere, or seen anything of promise, we needed a retreat. I was not Columbus. We needed some place to come back to more than we needed the possibility that someone might see and investigate the fire. I cut the foam pad to fit into the bottom of the sled, laid 2 blankets atop it, then I dressed Ashley in her clothes, strapped the brace back on her leg, zipped her up in the bag, slid her onto the sled, and lifted her head onto a 3rd blanket I'd folded into a pillow. The sled was hollow in the middle, putting a pocket of air between her backside and the snow. That meant she'd stay warm, and maybe just as important, stay dry, because the plastic sled was totally impervious to moisture. I tied the tarp down across the top of her to protect her from the snow. She thumped it from the underside. Snug as a bug in a rug. I tucked Napoleon in alongside her. He must have been worried, too, because he licked her face more than usual. I strapped on my gaiters, rolled up my jacket and placed it inside the sleeping bag with her. I grabbed the matches and lighter fluid, buckled myself into the harness, took 1 last look at the warm fire, and pulled her out the door and back into the never-ending snow. Surprisingly, I felt good. Not strong, but not tired and not as weak. If I had to guess, I'd say I'd lost more than 20 pounds since the crash. Maybe 25. A lot of that was muscle. Not all, but most. Losing it meant I'd lost some strength as well. The good news was that with the snowshoes, I was a bit lighter on my feet. I didn't have as much strength, but I didn't have as much to haul around either. If you didn't count Ashley in the sled, I probably hadn't been this light since high school. I tied a long tether from the harness around my shoulders and handed her the loose end. If you need me, just tug that. She nodded, looped the tether over her wrist, and tucked the tarp up under her chin. We walked out into the glowing daylight. Within minutes, we were climbing up the ridgeline en route to the trail leading out of the valley and through the notch. I seldom felt much tension on the harness because the sled glided well over the snow. The snow was blowing into my face, landing on my eyelashes, blurring my vision. I was constantly wiping my face. My plan was simple. Start walking and keep walking. Logically, and based on a rudimentary reading of the 3D map we'd found, I'd calculated we were probably looking at 30 or 40 miles, 50 on the outside, from any kind of road or something man-made. I hadn't given much thought to how far I could pull this sled. I tried not to think about it. I guess I thought I could make 30. I had my doubts about 50. If it turned out to be more than that, our chances were slim. Our path took us down small hills and up short rises, but on the whole I could tell we were losing elevation, and thankfully the path was mostly clear. That meant I wasn't spending a lot of energy stepping over and under debris, which allowed me to put more of my energy into moving forward. And I was comforted by the idea that we were on a path, a route taken by other people, and those other people had to come from somewhere. By lunch, I calculated we'd walked 3 miles. By mid-afternoon, we'd covered 6. I wondered what time it was, and out of habit, stared at my watch. The cracked crystal and condensation beneath the glass stared back at me. Toward dusk, the trail came down off a small hill and flattened out. I'd pushed it, and hard. I looked behind us, thinking back through each turn. Maybe we'd covered 10 miles. We spent the night beneath a makeshift shelter using our tarp, which had grown tattered, and some limbs I cut to help shed the snow. Ashley lay snug on the sled. She shrugged. "There's only room on here for one." I lay on the cold snow, a wool blanket and my bag separating me from the snow. "I miss our fire."
"Me too."
Napoleon was shivering. "I don't think he's too happy about this either," I said, and pulled him up close to me. He sniffed me and my bag, then hopped across the snow and dug himself in with Ashley. She laughed. I rolled over and closed my eyes. "Suit yourself." By mid-morning, we'd come down another 4 or so miles, and the temperature was warmer. Maybe just around freezing. The warmest it had been since the crash. On the hillsides, small shoots and twigs shot up through the snow, suggesting that the ground rested only a few feet beneath us, rather than 8 or 10. While we had lost elevation, down as much as 9,000 feet, the surface of the snow was wet and pulled at the sled, increasing the workload. Around mile 5, the trail dropped down, widened, and straightened, almost unnaturally. I stopped and scratched my head. I was talking to myself, pointing at the trail before me. Ashley spoke up. "What's wrong?" "This thing is wide enough to drive a truck down." That's about when it hit me. "We're on a road. There's a road beneath us." To our right, I saw something flat, green and shiny, sticking up a few inches through the snow. I brushed away the snow. It took me a minute to figure out what it was. I started laughing. "It's a road sign." I dug out around it. It said Evanston, 62. "I want to see. What's it say?" I stepped back into my harness. "It says Evanston, this way."
"How far?"
"Not very."
"Been pain?"
I shook my head and didn't look.
"Nope."
"How far?"
"You really want to know?"
A pause.
"Not really."
"That's what I thought." She tugged on the tether. I stopped again.
"Can we make it?"
I leaned into the harness.
"Yes, we can make it."
She tugged again.
"Can you pull this thing as far as that sign says we need to?"
I tightened my buckle and leaned into the weight of the harness.
"Yes."
"You sure?"
"Yep."
"'Cause if you can't, just tell me. Now would be a good time to come clean if you don't think—"
"Ashley?"
"Yes?"
Shut up.
You didn't say please.
Please.
Okay.
We walked 5 miles, most of which sloped downhill. It was relatively blissful walking. Night came, but with colder temperatures the sled slid easier, so I walked a few hours more, putting 10 miles on the road. 25 since the A-frame. Walking on the road was a lot like walking around the lake. Keep the trees on either side and walk down the white stuff in the middle. Sometime after midnight, I saw an odd-shaped tree, or shape, to my right. I unbuckled and investigated. A building, 8 feet square, with a roof and a concrete floor. The door had been left cracked open, so snow had spilled in. I dug out an entrance and slid the sled down into it. A laminated sign hung on the wall. I lit a match. It read, "This is an emergency warming hut. If this is an emergency, then welcome. If it's not, then you should not be in here." Ashley's hand found mine in the darkness. "Are we okay?"
"Yeah, we're good. I think we actually have someone's permission to be in here, except..." I unrolled my bag and climbed in. The floor was hard. I miss my foam mattress.
"You want to share mine?"
"Don't think I haven't thought about it, but I don't think there's room on that thing for two of us." She was quiet. "How's the leg?" I asked.
"Still hurts."
"Differently or the same?"
"Same."
"Let me know if it starts feeling different."
"And when it does, just what will you do about it?"
I rolled over, closed my eyes.
"Probably amputate. That way it'll quit hurting."
She slapped my shoulder.
"That's not funny."
"Your leg is fine. It's healing nicely."
"Am I going to need surgery when we get out of here?"
I shrugged. "We need to look at it under an X-ray. See how it looks."
"Will you do the surgery?"
"No."
"Why?"
"'Cause I'll be sleeping." She slapped my shoulder again.
"Ben Payne."
"Yes?"
"I want to ask you a question, and I want an honest answer."
"Good luck with that." A third slap.
"I'm not kidding."
"Okay."
"If we needed to, could we get back to the A-frame? I mean, if conditions were worse, is going back still an option?"
My bag had become tattered, having lost some of its down insulation. Cold spots appeared. Sleep would not be easy. I thought back through the miles since the A-frame. Most had been slowly losing elevation. I was pretty sure I could not make it back. "Yeah, it's still an option."
"Are you lying to me?"
"Yes."
"So which is it, yes or no?"
"Maybe."
"Ben, I still have one good leg."
"No."
"So there's no going back. We'll never see the A-frame again."
"Something like that."
I stretched out flat, staring up at the ceiling. Clouds had moved back in, so it was dark. Felt like we were in a hole, which, given the 8 feet of snow banked against the walls around us, we were. After a few minutes, she quietly slid her hand inside my bag and placed it flat across my chest. It stayed there all night.
"I know."
Chapter 43.
We started again at daylight. Ashley was chatty and I was feeling the effects of yesterday, not to mention the fact that our road was slowly turning upward. Gradual at first. It turned ugly 4 miles into the morning, gradually snaking and twisting its way up the mountain I'd been staring at for the last 2 days. Given the incline and the wet, sticky conditions of the snow, pulling the sled became a lot harder. I tightened the straps on my snowshoes, dug my hands beneath the straps, and leaned into it. It took me 3 hours to walk the next mile. By lunch, we'd made 5 miles total and probably regained 1,000 feet in elevation. And the road was still going up, and the snow was blowing into my face. By dusk, we'd made a total of 7 miles, but I was spent and my legs were cramping, I needed several seconds' rest between steps. I kept hoping we'd find another warming hut, but we did not, and I could walk no further to find it. We camped next to a spiraling aspen. I tied the tarp around it, anchored it to the end of the sled, rolled out a blanket on the snow, set my bag on top of it, and was asleep before my head hit the ground. I woke up in the middle of the night. Snow was falling heavy and weighing down the tarp. I pushed it up from underneath and dumped off the snow. I ate a bite of cold meat, sipped some water, and poked my head out. To the north, the clouds were clearing. I slipped on my boots, strapped on the snowshoes, and went for a walk, climbing up another several hundred feet. The road on the mountain was winding tighter toward the summit. The only encouraging thought was knowing that if we had to climb up it, then we also got to come down it. The road turned left sharply, and I bent over, catching my breath. My legs were sore and cramped quickly. Standing straight, I stared out across the darkness. The clouds were low, tucked down into the mountains. More cotton on a wound. Beyond that, maybe 30 or 40 miles, it cleared. I squinted. It took me a second to realize what I was looking at. I untied the tarp, folded it, and startled Ashley. She jerked.
What? What's going on?
I want you to see something.
Right now?
Yep. I buckled up and began pulling. What had taken me 15 minutes alone now took an hour. I walked faster, hoping it would stay clear just a few minutes longer, hoping she would get a chance to see it. My stomach muscles and the muscles on the front of my neck were sore. I was winded, and the straps were cutting into my shoulders. We rounded the corner. I pulled her up to the ledge, and we waited for the clouds to clear again. The wind cut through me. I slipped on my jacket and hid my hands inside my sleeves. After a few minutes, the clouds rolled off, and the view cleared. I pointed. A single light bulb sparkled some 40-plus miles in the distance. Beyond that, further to the north, a single trail of smoke. She clutched my hand, and neither of us said a word. The clouds came and went, rolling in and out on the wind. I took a reading on the compass, careful to let the needle settle and get an exact reading. 357 degrees, almost due north. She said,
"What are you doing?"
"Just in case." We stared at it for the rest of the night, hoping for more holes in the clouds. It had an orangish glow, which made me think it was some sort of street or utility light, something big enough to be seen this far away. We finally lost sight of it when the sun rose in the east and the world became a white-capped carpet once again. The road had brought us back up to around 11,000 feet. I needed sleep, but I knew I couldn't. I was too excited. We trudged across the snow quietly, thinking about the picture in our minds, the thought of a world out there with electricity, running hot water, microwavable food, and coffee baristas. The mountain plateaued. We walked several miles across what felt like the top of the world. The wind was steady, straight on, burned my face. The air was thin and the snow stung my cheeks. I leaned into it, numb, wanting more air, counting the miles in my head, maybe 45 to go. I walked, counting backward, talking to myself. 42 to the light bulb. 41 to the light bulb. When we got to 40, we came down into a saddle atop the mountain, a bowl protected from the wind. Halfway through it, we discovered another warming hut, this one bigger. One room, 3 metal bunk beds with mattresses, a fireplace, and enough wood for an entire winter. Above the door it read, "Ranger's Cabin." Inside I found the same laminated sign. Given the lighter fluid we'd stolen from the A-frame, getting a fire going was easy. I stacked the wood, doused it, and lit the outside. The flame caught, traveled inward, and blazed. Once I was sure it had caught, I pulled out of my wet clothes and hung everything on the bunks. I got Ashley situated, then fell onto my bed and didn't remember falling asleep. Chapter 44. She shook me.
Ben, you in there?
Yeah.
The day was full. Overcast, but not snowing.
Not yet.
I didn't know what time it was, but it had to be close to lunch.
You slept a long time.
I looked around, trying to remember where we were. My legs were sore. My feet felt like hamburger. In truth, all of me was sore. I sat up, but my legs and stomach muscles quickly cramped. I stretched, easing the knots out. Ashley handed me a Nalgene bottle mostly full of water. It was body temp warm and felt good going down my throat. I ate, sipped, and wondered how far we could get today. 30 minutes later, I was leaning into the harness, pulling. She tugged gently on the tether.
Ben?
I spoke over my shoulder.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know what day it is?
27.
4 weeks ago tomorrow?
I nodded.
So, today is Saturday?
Yeah, I think so.
I pulled on the harness, pushing my legs into the snowshoes. Ashley jerked the tether again.
You know, I've been thinking.
Yeah?
This losing weight stuff has been so easy that I think we need to capitalize on this whole deal.
How so?
We need to write a diet book.
A diet book?
Yeah. She sat up. Think about it. We've eaten almost nothing but meat and drunk only water and a few cups of coffee and tea since the wreck. I mean, look at us. Who's going to argue that it doesn't work?
I turned. I think our current diet is sort of a derivative of the Atkins or South Beach diet.
So?
Well, what will we call it?
How about the North Utah diet?
Too blah.
She snapped her fingers.
What's the name of these mountains?
The Wasatch National Forest.
No, the other name.
The High Uintas.
Yeah, we could call it the High Uintas Crash Weight Loss Diet.
Well, it sure has worked for us, no arguing that, but I think it's too strict and too expensive for most people.
How so?
Well, we've eaten mountain lion, trout, rabbit, and moose, and drunk only water, tea, and coffee. I just don't think the average American is going to pay good money for a 300-page diet plan that I just gave you in one sentence. Not to mention the fact that you can't get mountain lion at your local meat counter.
Good point.
I knelt and tightened one of my boots.
The whole thing is too simple. It needs to be more complicated. And you need to make people think it either originated with astronauts in space or actors in Hollywood.
Well, you can make it more adventuresome by crashing people into mountains, then letting them walk out with nothing but a dead pilot, a compound bow, an angry dog, and a messed up girl who missed her own wedding. I can pretty much guarantee that they'd lose more weight that way. She paused.
Are you going to go see Grover's wife?
Yes.
What will you tell her?
The truth, I guess.
Do you always do that?
What?
Tell the truth.
Yes.
I smirked. Except when I'm lying.
She stared up at me. How can I tell when you're lying?
I tightened the buckles, leaning forward, breaking the sled loose from the grip of the snow.
You'll know, 'cause I won't be telling you the truth.
How will I know that?
Well, if I look at you in the next 2 or 3 days and tell you I've just ordered a pizza and that it'll be here in 15 minutes, you'll know I'm lying.
You ever lie to a patient?
Sure.
What'd you tell him?
What I'm about to do won't hurt a bit.
I've heard that one.
She probed.
Ever lied to your wife?
Not about stuff that mattered.
Like?
Well, when we first started taking dance lessons, I told her we were going to a movie. We didn't. We went to the studio where this guy made me wear funny shoes and attempted to teach me how to dance.
I'd call that a good lie.
Me too, but it's still a lie.
Yeah, but it's justified. It's like the Jews in your basement thing.
What do you mean?
The SS knocks on your door. They ask, are you hiding Jews? You answer, nope, I'm not hiding Jews. When in truth, there are three families tucked down in your basement, quiet as a church mouse, or synagogue mouse. Anyway, it's a justifiable lie, the kind God understands.
She jerked the tether and held it, not letting the tension go.
Ben?
I knew what was coming. She'd been beating around the bush and was finally getting to it. I relaxed, and the tension in the harness went slack.
Ben?
I was looking forward.
Yes? You ever lied to me?
I turned, and this time I looked at her.
Depends.
The road flattened, then turned right and started descending off the plateau. Every few minutes, the clouds would blow over, momentarily clearing, and I could see the road winding down below us for what looked like 8 or 10 miles. It looked like we were soon to lose several thousand feet of elevation. The problem with such drastic elevation change meant steep pitches and the possibility of the sled getting away from me. The first 4 or 5 miles were blissful. Gradual decline, easy walking. At one point, the sun broke through and we saw blue skies. But late in the afternoon, around mile 6, the road corkscrewed and looked like it dropped off a tabletop. I took it slow and easy, winding my way down. If I started moving too fast, the sled would pick up speed and get away from me. With an hour to go before dark, the road descended and turned right in a huge horseshoe that curved some 10 miles in the distance. It bent around a valley off to our right. The hillsides were steep, but the valley was only 1/2 mile across. I weighed the difference. 10 miles versus 1/2 mile. If I worked us slowly down the steep incline, lowering Ashley with the rope slowly before me, then anchoring on another tree, moving tree to tree, we could be across the valley before nightfall and cut 10 miles out of our trip. 10 miles. With luck, we could make the light bulb tomorrow or the next day. I turned to Ashley. You up for a little adventure?
What'd you have in mind?
I explained. She eyed the distance, the valley, then the steep incline that dropped off 1/4 mile to our right, and then the valley below.
You think we can get down that?
We had been down steeper when we left the crash site, but we had yet to traverse anything this steep that was this long. If we take it slow.
She nodded.
I'm game if you are. There was a little voice inside my head whispering, shorter is not always better. I should have listened to it. I checked the harness ropes. The sled was secure. I slipped off the snowshoes, tied them to the sled, and began easing down the incline. I needed my boots to cut down into the snow, giving me leverage to hold the sled back. I lowered Ashley over the ledge, and she slowly slid down, pulling the harness tight. Then I began picking my way downhill, using the trees as my anchors. It actually worked quite well. I'd step down, dig a foot thigh-deep into the snow, anchoring myself, grab a tree or branch. We'd move forward, then I'd do it again. In 10 minutes, we were halfway down. That meant in 10 minutes, I'd cut out nearly 1/2 a day's worth of walking. Napoleon was sitting on Ashley's chest, staring at me. He didn't like it at all. If I could have asked his opinion, I have a feeling he would have told me to walk the 10 miles. 2 weeks of constant snow meant it had piled high. At times I was waist-deep, with another 10 feet below me. It didn't take much to set it loose. I don't remember it letting go. I don't remember tumbling and rolling. I don't remember the harness snapping, and I don't remember coming to an abrupt stop where, even though my eyes were open, all the world went black. The blood was rushing to my head, so I knew I was upside down
half-turned, and the snow was pressing in on me, allowing only shallow breaths. The only part of me free of the snow was my right foot. I could move it freely. I tried to clench my fists, pulling in, pushing out, trying to make room. I tried moving my head back and forth, but it was no good. I wasn't getting much air, and I knew I didn't have long. I began pulling my arms in, shoving, jerking. I knew I needed to get out and find Ashley. I began kicking my right foot, trying to clear away from snow. Above me, along my torso, I could see a faint light. Screaming was no use. 5 minutes later, I'd worked myself into a frenzy which produced absolutely no helpful result. I was stuck. And chances were good I was going to die upside down, frozen, and suffocating in the snow. When they found me, I'd be a blue popsicle.
We were so close. Why go through all we'd gone through to end here?
None of it made sense. Something with really sharp teeth began biting my ankle. I heard snarling and began kicking at it, but it wouldn't let go. Finally, I kicked it loose. Seconds later, I felt a hand on my foot. Then I felt snow being pulled away from my leg. Then more snow. I could move my whole leg. The second came free. Then the snow around my chest and, finally, a passageway to my mouth. Her hand shot in, pulled out the snow, and I sucked in the sweetest, largest breath of air I'd ever known. She worked out one arm, and with it, I righted myself, pulled myself out of that snowy grave and rolled onto my side. Napoleon, seeing me emerge, jumped onto my chest and began licking my face. It was almost dark, causing me to question what dim light I'd seen moments before. Ashley lay to my right. She was off the sled, out of her bag and lying on the snow. She was lying face down, trying not to move. Her hands were cut and bloody. Her cheek was swollen. And then I saw her leg. We didn't have long, and I knew I couldn't move her. The avalanche had carried us down to the base of the hillside. I'd been buried in the snowbank. The harness to the sled had evidently saved my life, because while the sled surfed the topside, it kept me, albeit only for a few seconds, from being totally swallowed by the snow. When the ropes broke, Ashley shot off the top like a missile, careening down the mountain and collided with a huge boulder laid there by the last ice age. She had worked her way back up to me, crawling. Her leg had rebroken, and this time the bone had pierced the skin. It was poking up underneath her pants. She was in shock, and any movement, absent drugs, would send her back into unconsciousness.
"I'm going to turn you."
She nodded. I did, and she screamed louder than I'd ever heard a woman scream. I crawled out across the snow and found the sled, stripped clean. Her sleeping bag lay crumpled where she left it when she climbed out of it. One wool blanket lay twisted around the sled. Everything else was gone. No pack, no food, no tarp, no water bottles, no lighter fluid, no down jacket, no snowshoes, no fire drill, and no fire. I unzipped her bag and laid her in it. Blood had soaked through her pants, spilled around her, and painted the snow. I pulled the sled up next to her, laid the wool blanket across the bottom, slid her on top of the sled, and wrapped the blanket over her. I wanted to cut away her pants and look at her leg, but she shook her head and managed to whisper, "Don't." She lay still, unmoving. Her bottom lip was shaking. I'd kill her trying to set the leg in place, and even then there was no guarantee. She'd lost blood, but not much. The bone had come out the top outside of her thigh, which was better than the inside. If it had gone the other way, through the femoral artery, she'd have been dead a long time ago, as would I. Clouds had moved in, and the snow returned, hastening the return of the darkness. I knelt, whispering,
"I'm going for help."
She shook her head.
"Don't leave me."
I tucked the bag around her. You've been trying to get rid of me since we started this trip, so I'm finally doing what you asked. She shook her head once more and said nothing. I leaned in, my breath on her face. I need you to listen to me. Her eyes were still closed. Ashley? She turned to me. The pain was rifling through her. I'm going for help. She gripped my hand, squeezed it tightly. I can't move you, so I'm leaving Napoleon here with you, and I'm going on for help. But I'm coming back. She tightened her grip as another wave shot through her. Ashley, I'm coming back. She whispered. Promise? Promise. She closed her eyes and let go of my hand. I kissed her on the forehead, then the lips. They were warm and trembling, and both blood and tears had puddled there. I tucked Napoleon in with her, stood, and stared off down the road. Clouds were thick, and I could not see where it went. Chapter 45. I've spent my life running. One of the things I've learned is to look just a few feet ahead, not more than 4 or 5 steps. It helps in long distance because you're already in a lot of pain, and breaking it into small, doable pieces is about all you can handle. Others will tell you to keep your eyes up, focus on the finish line, but I've never been able to do that. I can only focus on what's in front of me. If I do that, the finish line will come to me. So, I put one foot in front of the other. The road wound down, snaking toward the valley in which we'd seen the orange light and single smokestack. I figured I had 25 to 30 miles to go, and if I was lucky, I was averaging 2 miles an hour. All I had to do was run until the sun rose over my right shoulder. I could do that, couldn't I? Yes. Unless I came to the end of myself first. That wouldn't be so bad. What about Ashley? What about Ashley? I closed my eyes, and Ashley was all I could see. It was 3, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning. Day 28, I think. I'd fallen 1,000 times and pulled myself up 1,001. The snow had turned to sand. I could smell and taste salt. I heard a seagull somewhere. My dad was standing at the guard shack, a donut and coffee in his hand, a scowl on his face. I slapped the red lifeguard's chair, cussed him beneath my breath, turned and kept running, picking up the pace. What if I beat him home? The beach stretched out before me, and every time I thought I was getting close to the house, it would fade, reset, and the beach would lengthen, and another event or moment would take its place. The past played before me like a movie. I remember falling, pulling with my hands, standing and falling again and again. Many times I wanted to quit, lie down, and sleep. When I did, I'd close my eyes and Ashley was still there, lying quietly in the snow, laughing over a leg of rabbit, chatting from the sled, yakking from the kitchen in the tub, embarrassed over a Nalgene bottle, shooting the flare gun, sipping coffee, pulling me out of the snow. Maybe it was those thoughts that got me up and helped me put one foot in front of the other. Somewhere under the moon, on a flat section with a concrete bridge and a river trickling below me, I fell, eyes wide open. The picture changed. I saw her. Rachel. Standing alone in the road, running shoes on, sweat on her top lip, trickling down her arms, hands on her hips, she motioned me forward and whispered. I couldn't hear her at first, but she smiled and whispered again. Still nothing. I looked down, tried to move, but the snow had frozen around my feet and clung to me. I was stuck. She ran, held out her hand and whispered, "Run with me?" Rachel before me, Ashley behind me, torn between the two,
running both ways. I reached, pulled, took a step and fell again. Then again. And again. Soon, I was running, chasing Rachel. Her elbows were swinging, her toes were barely touching the ground, and I was back on the track with the girl I'd met in high school. The road led up to a gate and a sign of some sort. I don't remember what it said. She ran with me, up the hill, toward the sunlight, and when it cleared the mountaintop, I fell, face forward for the last time. My body would not go. I could run no more. I had done something I'd never done. Reached the end of myself. She whispered, "Ben." I lifted my head, but she was gone. I heard her again. "Ben." "Rachel?" I could not see her. "Get up, Ben." In the distance, a few hundred yards away, a single column of smoke spiraled above the trees. It was a log cabin. Several snowmobiles parked out front. Snowboards leaning against the porch railing. Lights inside. A fire's reflection off the wall. Deep voices. Some laughter. The smell of coffee. And maybe Pop-Tarts. I crawled up the drive, climbed the steps, and pushed open the door. Given my experience in ERs, I'm practiced at squeezing as much information into as few words as possible while still conveying what's needed. But as the door pushed open, all I could muster was a cracking whisper. "Help." Moments later, we were screaming across the snow. My driver was wiry, on the short side, and his snowmobile was not slow. With the engine wound, I glanced around him at the electronic speedometer. The first time it read 62, the second time it read 77. With one hand I held on for dear life. With the other I pointed up the road. He followed my finger. The other two guys followed us. We made it into the valley and I pointed again. Ashley's blue sleeping bag lay flat and highlighted against the snow on the far side. She was not moving. Napoleon barked at us and spun Tasmanian devil's circles in the snow. The kid cut the engine. In the distance, I could hear the helicopter. When I made it to her, Napoleon was licking her face and looking at me. He was whining. I knelt. "Ashley?" She opened her eyes to look up at me. The kids popped a green handheld flare, and Life Flight landed in the road. I briefed the medics. They got her breathing oxygen, injected her with painkillers, loaded her onto a stretcher, started an IV, and slid her into the single-patient bay of the helicopter. I backed out. They began winding up the propeller, and she reached for me. I gave her my hand, and she slid something into it. The helicopter lifted, dipped its nose forward, and shot across the mountains, blinking red lights fading in its wake. I opened my hand. The recorder. It was warm where she'd held it close to her. The tether had broken, the frayed ends spreading across my hand. I must have lost it in the avalanche. I stared at it, pushing the power button, but it would not play. The red warning light for low battery was flashing, keeping time with the one on the tail of the helicopter. The kid I'd ridden with slapped me on the back. "Dude, mount up." My knees nearly buckled. I grabbed Napoleon and we climbed on. Coming into town, the posted speed limit was 55. Tucked behind him, I peered around the kid's shoulders. The speedometer read 82, and he was laughing. Chapter 46. It was a single room. She lay beneath a sheet of white, sleeping beneath a fog of sedation. Her vitals were good, strong. Blue lights and numbers flickered above her. I turned the blinds, keeping daylight at bay. I sat, her hand resting in mine. Her color had returned. Life Flight had bypassed Evanston and rerouted her directly to Salt Lake, where in 2 hours the ER docs put in a few bars and pins. When I arrived in Evanston atop a snowmobile, they were waiting on me. I was loaded into an ambulance and, with a police escort, sped to Salt Lake. They started me on an IV and began asking me a bunch of questions. The answers surprised them. By the time we arrived in Salt Lake, camera crews were everywhere. They put me in a room, and I asked for the chief of surgery. His name was Bart Hampton, and we'd met him on more than one occasion at conferences around the country. He had been briefed on our situation, and when he learned it was me, he, along with the nurse feeding my IV, led me to a viewing room above the OR where we observed the last hour of Ashley's surgery. The intercom allowed the doctors to talk me through what they were seeing, what they were doing. She was in good hands. There was no need to interfere. My body was trashed, and my hands were little more than raw meat. I was in no condition to be a doctor. They rolled her into her room and quickly left. I walked in, flipped the switch on the light, and viewed her x-rays pre- and post-op. I could have done no better. She'd make a full recovery. Tough as she was, probably better. I turned. Blue light above her lit her forehead, showered the sheets. I pushed her hair back and gently placed my lips to her cheek. She was clean, smelled like soap, and her skin was soft. I slid my hand beneath hers, blistered to tenderness. I whispered in her ear, "Ashley, we did it." Somewhere in there, my adrenaline ran out. I was falling when Bart caught me. He laughed. "Come on, Steve, time to get you to bed." All I wanted to do was sleep. Something about his comment didn't register. "What did you call me?" "Steve." As in Steve Austin. "Who's he?" "The $6 million man." The next thing I knew, it was daylight, and I was in a bed with white sheets in a room filled with the aroma of fresh coffee, where the sounds of people talking echoed down the hall. Bart was standing over me, holding a styrofoam cup. The perspective was odd. I was used to standing in his shoes, not lying in mine. "That for me?" He laughed. It was good coffee. We talked a while. I gave him more of the details. He listened mostly, shaking his head. When I finished, he said, "What can I do for you?" "My dog. Actually, he's not mine, but I've fallen in love with the little guy, and he's in my office, sleeping. Fed him some steak. Happy as can be. I need a rental car, and I need for you to protect us from the media until she's ready to talk to them." "She?" "Yeah, I'm not." "I suppose you have your reasons."
"I do."
"You know, when the details of this get out, they're going to want you to on every talk show in the country. You could be an inspiration to a lot of people."
"Anybody would have done what I did."
"Ben, you've been doctoring long enough to know that very few people on the planet could have done what you did. For more than a month, you hauled that woman in sub-freezing temperatures nearly 75 miles. I stared out the window at the white-capped mountains in the distance. It was strange, looking at them from the other side. A month ago, I had stood in the Salt Lake City airport and wondered what was on the other side. Now I knew. I imagined prison bars the same way. Maybe a grave. I just put one foot in front of the other. "I called your people at Baptist in Jacksonville. They were elated, to say the least. Glad to know you're alive. They'd been wondering what happened to you. Said it was unlike you to just fall off the face of the earth."
"I appreciate it."
"What else? Seems like I ought to be able to do more to help you." I raised one eyebrow. "In my hospital, we know our best nurses. They tend to stand out. If you could..." He nodded.
Already took care of it.
She's got them now, and we'll have around the clock. I turned my empty cup.
Anybody around here make a latte? Maybe a cappuccino?
All you want.
His answer rattled around inside my head. We were now back in a world where as much coffee as we wanted was available upon request. The disconnect was almost audible. Late morning, she stirred. I walked down the hall, bought what I needed, and came back. When she cracked open an eye, I leaned in, whispered,
"Hey."
She turned, slowly opening her eyes.
"I talk with Vince. He's on his way. Be here in a few hours."
Her nose twitched. One eyebrow lifted slightly.
"Do I smell coffee?"
I pulled off the lid and held it beneath her nose.
"Can you just drip it into my IV?"
I held the cup to her lips. She sipped.
"Second best cup of coffee I've ever had."
She laid her head back, tasting the beans. I sat on the rolling stainless steel stool and scooted up next to her bed.
"Your surgery went well. I consulted with your doctor. We've actually met before, sat on a panel together at a conference. Knows his stuff. I'll show you the x-rays when you want to see them."
Out the window, a jetliner was taking off from the airport in the distance. We watched it gain altitude, turn, and bank across our mountains.
She shook her head.
"I'm never flying again."
I laughed.
"They'll have you up and walking in about 3 hours. Good as new."
"Are you lying to me?"
"I don't lie about people's medical conditions." She smiled.
"It's about time you gave me some good news. I mean, how long have we been hanging out, and all you've had for me is one bad bit of news after another."
"Very true."
She stared at the ceiling, shuffling her legs beneath the sheets.
"I really want to take a bath and shave my legs."
I rolled to the door and motioned for the nurse. She followed me in. "This kind lady's name is Jennifer. I've explained to her where you've been the last month. She'll help you into the shower, get you what you need. When you get cleaned up, there's another lady waiting outside your door. Something I promised you." She stared at me out of the corner of her eyes.
"What are you scheming?"
"I made you a promise a while back. I intend to keep it." I patted her foot. "I'll check on you later. Vince lands in 2 hours. She pushed back the sheet, reached for me. She held my hand.
"How do you explain to other people what we've been through? How do you articulate that?
We'd just walked through hell, a hell that had frozen over, and survived. Together. I didn't have the words. Neither did she." I patted her hand.
"I know. It takes some getting used to. I'll be back."
She squeezed tighter.
"You okay?"
I nodded and walked out. An attractive Asian lady sat in a chair, waiting patiently, a bag on her lap. "She's showering. Be ready in a bit. I don't know what color she likes, but you can ask her." I handed her $100 bill. "This okay?" She shook her head and started digging in her bag.
"Too much."
I waved her off. "Keep it. Just take your time. That lady in there has had a rough go." She nodded, and I walked downstairs to the grill. The grill was typical hospital short order, but it'd have to do. I stepped to the counter. "I'd like a loaded double cheeseburger with a double order of fries, all the way." "Anything else?" "Can you please have someone deliver it to room 316 in an hour?" She nodded, I paid, and then I walked to my rental car and typed the address into the dash-mounted GPS. Chapter 47. It was a simple house, not too far from town. White with green shutters, white fence, sitting up on a hill, flowers all around, no weeds, The mailbox was marked by one of those flags they use at airports. The hollow kind that